So, good evening, everyone. Nice to see you all. It's kind of an odd, strange feeling because in these recent days, I've been going through old photographs from the 20 years of Wildflower. And so I feel like I've been seeing you all every day from the years and years ago. Some really old pictures. So it's funny to see you now. It's like I've been seeing you all this time. But of course, looking at pictures and looking at the screen is not the same thing as being with people. And that's what's so precious about our practice is that through these 20 years, we've been together in so many different places and circumstances and events. You know, I have pictures of us sitting morning zazen on the beach, and I have a picture of having lunch on the beach with Grisha. And you know, there's like 11 years apart, 10 years apart from those things. And so different places, different people, different situations. But the same thing that is shared is that we were at that moment together. And we're together because of this practice. And this practice brings us together, and we are together because of this practice. So I've been contemplating a lot of this, as I said last week. Although I don't know who was here. Well, Lisa, I think, was the only one who was here last week. No, and Lisa was not here last week. No, that's right. Okay. So nobody was here last week. So I could give the same talk, and it wasn't recorded, so no one would know, right? I don't remember what I said, but I know that I did mention that since August, I've really been like a koan almost looking at, okay, 20 years. What have I done? What is this that has been happening for 20 years? What am I doing now? And what will I do next 20 years or tomorrow or the next minute? And it's came upon me quite by surprise when we were in Holland for Bart's transmission. And I so it was a transmission, and I feel like I talked about this. Maybe it was in the study group, or maybe it was last week. I don't know. But it became so clear to me. Every transmission is different, of course. The rituals are the same, but the people are different. The circumstances are different. The place is different. The sangha is different, and at this particular retreat, there was, of course, Lisa and Joa were there too, and then my Dharma brothers and sisters, and Gena Roshi, and Bart, of course, and all of his comrades and his sangha. But it just really struck me the two nights when we were doing the ceremonies, how very personal it is, and how very impersonal. That it's not about the person and his teacher, and yet it is. And then that kind of started my reflections, I think. And then hearing my own teacher give a Dharma talk, started some reflections. I haven't heard her give a Dharma talk probably since, well, when we had that big Mahasangha gathering in Fondu, she gave a talk. And at Joa, since his transmission week, she gave a talk. But that's not very often. You know, I don't hear talks from her very often. And of course, she's evolved in the 20 years since I really drifted away from Donna. Of course, she's evolved. I've evolved too, you know. And it was just really surprising to hear her Dharma talk. And then to talk to my Dharma brothers and sisters, and I just this came up for me. What am I doing? What have I done? And someone who I was talking to this about, one of my Dharma brothers, he understood what I was saying, but at the same time, he said, "But look, you have this beautiful sangha, you have this great successor, you, what's your problem?" And it's not a problem. It's not a problem. It's just my reflection as like a koan, kind of healthy, like when you, I don't know, when you turn 40 or 30 or something, and you start thinking, "Wait a minute, what? What am I going to do now? What have I done with my life?" So I've been going through this. It's very rich, and looking through the photos has brought up a lot. Because at the same time, we all look different than we did in 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8. And we have pictures from all those years. We all look very different. Some of the people are not even around anymore. At least one of them is dead. Two of them that I know of are dead, have died since then. And yet, it's the same, The essential of what we're doing is the same. The Jukai ceremonies, I have long hair, I have short hair, I'm wearing my robe, I'm not wearing my robe. It's a different person standing there. It's in a different place. And yet the Jukai and what happens is the same. And it's not about me, and it's not about the other person. And it's wonderful to look at all these different Jukai ceremonies because it's so rich. It's all these wildflowers. It's this bouquet of wildflowers. Little parentheses. Debbie, do you have any pictures from your Jukai? Did anyone take pictures?
I'm trying to, I know I do on my phone. How do you, if you tell me, not right now, maybe, how I get off my phone onto paper. I have three or four on my phone yet. I don't think I have them on paper
From
yet.
your Jukai.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, that would be great. And Joa, if you have any of your cats, like maybe sitting on the cushion or something, so all of these, this has all been happening. And then today, someone told me a story about the wife of the Turkish leader, Erdogan, the Turkish leader, and his wife. Apparently, I don't know anything about his wife, but I heard this story. But apparently, when they were on a trip to Brussels, some diplomatic thing, maybe he was going to the European Union or NATO or something, they ordered that a big shopping mall be closed so that she could shop. And have it all to herself. And she spent, thousands and thousands and thousands of euros in this shopping spree where they closed down the shopping mall just for her. And that this is apparently compulsive. She's a big shopper, and this kind of thing happens regularly. And that in her, they live in this just palatial residence in Ankara in Turkey. In order to cover the floors and things, the carpets, it's like millions of dollars worth of carpets to cover the floors of this huge palace that they live in. And when I heard this story, I was just, the first thing that came to mind was just this deep sadness. And I said, "Oh, poor people. Poor people. It's pauvre gens, And so we had this little discussion about it, and it was really heartfelt when I said this, poor people, that they would devote their time and their energy and their power to accumulating wealth and possessions, And poor in the sense that it's like this realm of the hungry ghosts that we talk about, where it's never enough. And that there's this deep sense of lack, of missing something, of not having, which is really sad. It's a horrible feeling, which we can all identify with because we've all felt it or do feel it at times. Whether it's, we feel like we're not worthy, or we feel like we want a different car, or we think people are better than us, we compare, things like that. But this sense of lack of missing out, and then having to spend all of our time thinking that we will be able to remedy it by closing the shopping mall and buying everything. Or, of course, you can say, well, they live in this big palace. They have to cover the floors with carpets, right? Well, but it's kind of a catch-22. If you have a big palace, then you have the complications that come with having a big palace. If you have a small house, then you have the complications of what comes with a small house, but you won't have to spend millions of dollars on carpets. So I started this came into my reflections about, what am I doing, and the kind of the notion of, in Buddhism, there's considered two kinds of giving. Material giving of material goods and being generous with material resources, and giving of the Dharma and being, generous with the Dharma. And one of our precepts, we say, I vow to refrain from being stingy, especially with the Dharma. And the giving of both of those is valid. Of course, in the Buddhist teachings, we go into this thing of like, well, so what is true giving? What is selfless giving? What is perfect giving? All of these different definitions. Of course, as with all things, the precepts and all of these paramitas, the notion of no self allows for what we would call perfect giving. There is no one giving to someone else. And if I look at my own, path of in this 20 years, I did, and I do, and I will. So when I look back, what have I done? What am I doing, and what will I do? It has always been my vow to, as I say to each one of you, if you engage with me as a student, I vow to give to the best of my ability to accompany you and help you achieve your way, to realize your true self. And that has very and that is a selfless vow. I'm not doing that for me, and I'm not necessarily doing it for you, in the sense of an individual that comes back to these transmission ceremonies of being an individual I. And so the giving of the Dharma and the generosity of that, if I look back on my path and where I am now, of course, to differing degrees, it has been selfless. At some moments it was not, because it wasn't that I thought I was a great teacher and I was doing great things. It was more like I thought I was bad. I wasn't good enough. And I didn't know how to do it, and I didn't know what I was doing. But that too has evolved. And the essential point has not been lost, ever. The essential point of awakening to the oneness of life has never been lost. Even when I, was attached to a poor view of myself as a teacher or something. And I have, maybe some of you have heard me tell this story about when. So this would have been, probably 2005. I think it was 2005, or 2000, early 2006, maybe. Yeah, early 2006. And it wasn't happening in Portugal. We were trying to. I'd been coming since October of 2004, and we, stupid me. Of course, it was just my way. I was trying to replicate the way that I had been trained with my teacher, and having weekends and residential weekends, and people would come. But this was in a completely different context with people who didn't know anything about this practice, and they didn't know me. And we didn't have a center, and you can't expect people to just engage and come for a weekend when they don't know anything about practice, right? Some people might, but generally people aren't going to do that. And so it seemed like a failure. So we had decided to, with Margarita, who was at the origin of the Sangha with me there, decided to just have, we would do a weekend in Porto, in the Buddhist Union in Porto, but it was basically just 2 days of introduction. So people could come on Saturday and have a full day of introduction, and they could come on Sunday. Different people could come on Sunday. The same people could come for the 2 days, but it was just introductory workshops, not residential. There was lunch provided, but that was it. And they were full, these workshops. Lots of people came. I can't tell you how many people came back and eventually came to practice with us, but that's how we then created a sangha, more or less, was by doing that. But until then, so then in January of 2006, and in Paris, we were a really small group. It was basically Joa and Delphine, and I think Sophie was there. Tomas had not arrived yet. Freddie, maybe, but I'm not sure. It was very small. And I did, a lot of people had asked me to do a retreat over the new year. So this would have been 2004, 2005, the new year. And so I did at Dana, and nobody came. I mean, like, think one, two, think there were like three full-time practitioners. There was a couple who had a baby, so they switched off and on. Maybe we were four, five people maximum, And I was really discouraged, and I thought, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to teach. This is not worth it, And so I went to my teacher's teacher retreat that we went to every January, in which I really hated going to, but I did it for my teacher, basically. And he decided, my teacher's teacher, Genpo, decided one night that he was going to do this huge ceremony. There were 300 people there, right? And he was going to have this huge kind of like Jukai ceremony for 300 people. But he invented it and took in some Tibetan aspects and chanting and stuff. And the teachers who were present would all sit in front of the group in a line, and each person who wanted to could come up and bow before each teacher and receive the water like we do with Jukai, from each teacher. And I think there were nine of us, and I was at the end. No, Frank was at the end, and I was right before him. And neither Frank nor I had ever done a ceremony before. We were really new to this. And I was at, during this retreat, I couldn't even chant, like the four vows. I felt like throwing up if I chanted the four vows. So all of this ritual stuff was like, ugh, get me out of here, And I was really depressed and upset, and I just hated the whole thing. I wanted to quit, And nobody knew what was wrong with me. And Genpo and Gen Urosi were trying to, like, well, what's wrong with you? You know, why don't you just do this, or why don't you do that? Or they didn't want me to stop, basically. And so this night, I could have said no, but I didn't. And so here I am sitting there with my kesa, my robes, all this stuff. And someone comes and brings us a tray of bowls of water that they just filled up in the kitchen and roses that they had just cut off from the bouquet in the altar, and gives us each these things on a little plate. And we're supposed to do this ritual with everyone who comes by. And I was like, what? This is so dumb. You know, what am I doing? You know, what is this thing I'm wearing? You know, and but I don't know, something made me stay there, and so I did it. And people were coming, and there's all this chanting and these drums, boom, 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 and incense. You know, there's 300 people who are going to come down this line of nine teachers. You know, it's going on and on and on. And at one point, someone, I don't know who, I don't even know if it was a woman or a man, I didn't know the person, was in front of me. And when I was doing it, I met the person's eyes. We like looked at each other. And for some reason, at that moment, something broke, you know, something gave way. And I realized, it suddenly became so clear to me that I was just a like a tube through which this was passing, through which the vows were being transmitted, through which the teaching was coming, through which the manifestation of the Dharma was happening. I was just this tube through which it was passing. And it was had been until that moment, it had been blocked, you know, like if you had a tube that's blocked by all of me. You know, all this stuff about me, I'm not good, this isn't good, I don't know how to do it. Everything, me. Amy had been like clogging this tube. And suddenly, it was like effortless. And it just flowed then. And after the ceremony, and we all went back to Genpo's place for like a little party, and not 300 people. That's not how it works with Genpo. It was like for the teachers, and you know, special people get to go to this party. And I walked in, and he looked at me, and he was like, "Whoa, what happened to you? You're like transformed." So I guess my face even looked transformed by this. And that was a really important moment in my process of teaching and in generosity and renunciation and not holding back and not identifying with the, because we can identify with I'm just a tube as well. It's not that either, huh? It was a kind of perfect giving in that moment. I'm not saying that I always experience that at every moment, but that was such a powerful moment that I know it, you know, it's in me. And that helped me evolve. That having had that experience helped me evolve. And like I said, then in Portugal, things changed. And in France, that summer, then we did our first summer retreat. Thanks to the generosity of Caroline McCarthy, who let us use her house for like hardly any money. You know, we didn't really have to pay much because I couldn't afford, I never knew how many people would come. And we had a good turnout. You know, some of my Donna brothers and sisters came, kind of like some of you go to Joa's retreats. You know, that really helps and is important for a new teacher to have the support of their sangha. But you know, Joa was there, Delphine was there, Sophie was there, Freddie was there, Christine was there. At that first retreat in 2006. And from there, we just never looked back. So this was a this for me, this was a teaching in generosity. And I never forget that the name my teacher gave to her sangha is Dana, which is generosity. And I'm still, it's still a koan for me as to why she did that, but I guess that's part of what she transmitted to us, you know. She's just generous, very generous with her teachings and with her home. You know, we the center is her house. And no, people don't usually think about that. They think, oh, it's the Dana Zen Center, but it's her house. She's the owner of that place, and she gave it over to the Sangha, really, except for her part of it. So I guess this week, today, my thoughts on where I've been and what I've done and where I'm going are about generosity, maybe. And hearing about Erdogan's wife was so painful almost to hear that, you know. And the hungry ghosts, what realm that they are in, you know, and they're not alone by any means. Someone, I forget who it was, and somewhere recently I read that, you know, that generosity or greed are best understood as an achievement or a circumstance of an entire society. It's not just something that individuals in a society manifest. So, you know, the fact that we live in this world where greed is almost institutionalized, you know, and you know, the capitalist system has been taken to such pushed to such an extent that, and this affects then relationships too. That someone else was telling me that they had never known what Marxism was, and then they started reading Marx, and not in terms of like, you know, economic resources, but in how it affects relationships and how it affects how we build a society, you know, of inequality. Even how we treat each other. It doesn't have to be so much, it's not even basically about resources. So it's not just an isolated thing, it's an entire cultural phenomenon. So the fact that, you know, the leader of Turkey and his wife are like in this situation of accumulating and using their power to do that, it's not an isolated incident by any means. Yeah. So I guess, yeah, our Sangha is, you know, a branch of Dana. So of course, and wildflowers are generous. You know, wildflowers don't hold anything back. They just bloom wherever. And they don't pick and choose. They make do with their circumstances and offer themselves freely. So there is this notion of generosity in our very name as well. Without thinking about what the rewards will be, you know. Or if I take the example of Joanne Delphine, who for 20 years invited us to sit in their apartment in Paris, and there was no like notion of what their reward would be in return for it. I don't think anyone ever even thought about that. At least I never felt like anyone was thinking that. Or, you know, we did a retreat at Marlene's. I don't think Marlene was thinking that she was going to get some reward in return for hosting it. And I wish we could do other retreats at Marlene's because it was so great, Marlene. And we have pictures from that those retreats too, actually. And, you know, I could give examples of each one of you on the screen of some act of generosity without a thought of self. You know, it's like selfless giving. It's not waiting for anything in return. Which is truly the Mahayana way, the Mahayana being the large vehicle, not great in better than the others, but large that it encompasses everything, everyone, everywhere. Yeah, someone else said that this notion of perfect giving, we have to reflect on how contingent our situation is, you know? So, contingency of fortune. So, we all are very privileged to be sitting here, you know? And it's like just circumstances of our existence has made it so that we could be, so that we're not homeless, so that we can have a computer, so we can have a Wi-Fi connection. So that we can have food and shelter. And that's the contingency of our fortune, right? And we can reflect then when we see a homeless person, we can say, oh, they did not have the contingency of fortune that I had. And not that it's better or worse, but it's a way of seeing it as all kind of interdependent, the circumstances of it all. One little thing different, and we wouldn't be sitting here. No. Even to the extent of, had that person in that retreat not sat in front of me and looked at me in the eye, I might not be sitting here right now. Don't know. That helps us to not be attached to what we think of as our possessions. Or our actions, even. Of course, we're responsible for our actions, and we are responsible for taking care of what belongs to us, and we can offer it with generosity, selflessly, whatever. At the same time, it's all empty. That allows us to be even more free and even give more freely. So I should thank, you know, Mr. Erdogan's wife for having closed that shopping mall and gone on a shopping spree because that really spoke to me today. And the person who told me the story. So maybe I will stop now. I'm on my iPad because I have a problem with my computer, so I can't see the time. Oh, okay. So yes, maybe I should stop there and have allow you to question, comment, offer moment of generosity of your words. Merlin.
Evening, everyone. I think I have just 10% of the charge, but if I shut down, well, I heard this what you have been saying, and this word when the moment everything changed, and you see things so differently. And this word was effortless, effortless. Yeah, I can attune with some situations, not this one, but others in retreats too. For instance, there was one time that being a dancer was so difficult for me. So difficult during the retreat. And I thought, no, I'm going to say, I don't want to do it more. Someone come and came with me and change because it's really difficult. But I remember that same after the retreat when I came home, it was the shift that doing this to the ends and what it's kind of this me was not, this me was gone during the retreat, the me that want not to do it. It was gone. And when I came home, it was really a kind of a liberation, you know, because I've not been with Marlene, this me, for a while. And it was so good. It felt so good when I come home. Yeah. But even so, this word effortless, and at first you did not want to be there and do those rituals and things like this. When is it the moment that really? Because I think that sometimes we are pretty sure we don't want to do it, and we can come and say, well, honestly, it would not be good for anyone. There are times, I don't know, there must be a reason no one said no when you distribute our works in the beginning of the retreats, but there must be a reason because I don't know, but it's kind of a miracle because certainly there are people that is not suited to do some works. I know the one I am not too. I've said it before. And not now at 67, please don't put me being the timekeeper. No, please. No, please. Yeah. It's true. Well, I have to go and charge the battery. Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't know Marlene didn't want to be the timekeeper.
No.
Hello, everybody.
Diana.
Thank you, Emir Roci, for your Dharma talk and for remind us of all those important facts that we, well, I try to, I tend to forget and to look at as not making part of life and not making part of our practice. So in your talk, I felt more and more, you know, like my chest was full. Full of what? Full of gratitude to you to do that exercise of look, this is everyday things, and this makes everything. This is part of everything. I don't know if I'm explaining exactly what I feel, but it touched me really strong. Well, they usually your talks touch me, but today maybe because I've been away a long time and then I'm here, back here. It was really important to show the important things, which I relate also with what happened in my street, what has been happening in my street, what has been happening last weekend around my quarter, which is full of people from all over the world. This is the quarter in Lisbon where there are more nationalities living and more people. So my street is the world, you know, and it's very busy with sometimes it's not very nice because there are lots of fights, sometimes very strong. And very violent. Well, I think I'm losing myself. But anyway, I feel that it's all this is related, really. And that's all. Thank you, Amy Roshi.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to your experience in the beginning. This is where I am now. Just a couple of very recent anecdotes. Yesterday I was in a new institution and they were very excited to offer that to students, and they called me before and they said, how do you want the room to be organized and all that. It's like, oh, whatever, you know, just chairs is fine. They didn't have any cushions. And so when I arrived, they had set up 40 chairs. And I was like, wow, so many people, you're really expecting that many? And then they said, yeah. I said, how many students is there? They said about 100. So I said, you're expecting 40% of the people to show up? You seem very optimistic. And so I was like, yeah, whatever. And she said, yeah, if there's not enough chairs, you know, just call me and I'll bring more chairs. And four people came up. Last week on Friday, I did two workshops and I saw altogether about 100 people. And then the following Monday, I was doing the regular workshop and I was expecting to have a higher turnout. And there was probably out of these 100 people, one person that came. So, of course, it's very hard not to feel inadequate, to feel really just not good. So I hear you with a, is there someone blocking the pipe? Is the pipe blocked? I don't think the pipe is blocked, but and today I was working with a girl who does my website and for institutions, and I was like, I find it impossible to just kind of, what is it to sell? What am I selling? I'm supposed to write something about what I'm selling or what my services. I'm like, you know, it's very difficult. So, and yes, it's a great support to have the Sangha also. Wonderful to have Debbie also, you know, coming up to the retreats. That's great, great support. Even if maybe Debbie, you don't see it as support, but it does. It does. It is hard. I find it really hard, but I'm really giving myself completely to it. Just all the energy and resources I have. But it is hard not to evaluate myself out of the numbers of the people who come, who show up, and dropping that idea, but it is hard. I find it really hard, but essential.
Thank you so much, Amy and Roshi. First of all, I love stories about the history of the Sangha. And it's coming up now, but there have been times when Joel would because a lot of this happened before I was on the scene. So I'm getting bits and pieces of what y'all were doing before. And I don't know, is there a way to write it down, or should we tape it or something? Because it's so interesting to see how it evolved. And also this, well, there are a whole many, many things that you said. I say the precepts every morning, and the one you mentioned, I don't really understand. I make the vow to avoid being stingy with my practice and the Dharma. How could I be stingy with the Dharma? I have no, does this mean like beating somebody up at the Galdino? No, what does that mean? Being stingy with the Dharma.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question and it's a good koan. You know, stingy means to cling, to withhold, to not give freely, and to think that, you know, or just to give little bits. You know, someone who's stingy just gives a little bit. Whereas, and so we can understand that with material things, right? Mm-hmm. Can understand if someone says, oh, can I taste your fries? And you like give them half of one, you know, instead of like holding the plate up and say, sure, help yourself. You know, that we can understand that. So the Dharma, it's the same, you know. I was really super stingy with the Dharma when I was like, you know, oh, poor me, nobody's coming, and I don't know how to do this. And I was really holding back, you know. And even in those days, I was convinced, I said, I'm not going to give Jukai. There was nobody who knew anything about Jukai in Portugal. Nobody knew any of this, you know. Joa already had Jukai. Nobody else was interested in France, you know. And then someone asked me. And then I was in big trouble, right? So if I'd said no, well, that would have been really stingy.
But you are a transmitter of the Dharma. When so I say that to myself, I mean, when I say that about myself, what does it mean for me to be stingy with the Dharma?
But you're a transmitter of the Dharma too. We all are. You know, I have this official position where I'm supposed to do things, but every single one of us is a transmitter of it and a manifestation of it. And so, you know, it would be like, well, it could be like, so you offer to open the sessions. You know, that's being generous. If you refuse, if some people don't want to do it, now I can't commit, or I don't know how to, or I'm embarrassed or something, that would be kind of stingy then. Mm-hmm. Or it can be not, if someone asks you a question about it, not answering or saying, oh, you can't understand, or thinking, well, I don't know how to explain it, so I'm not going to tell them, instead of just sharing your experience. Mm-hmm. Because that's your Dharma, you know.
Okay. And the other thing that you brought up was this L1 business. I participated in a study. I didn't, after a while, I couldn't follow anymore, but I began the Course in Miracles with people during COVID with people online. And we got to a passage about that, I don't remember exactly the passage, but about obsessive sort of binge getting. And I didn't know the people. I knew one, no, I knew two people, and there were six of us. The other ones, one of them was in New York. I never met the other people. But all of a sudden, as we were saying this, she and I said the same thing at the same time. It's like a drug addiction. This having to, obsessive buying, this impulse buying. It was the minute it came out of her and my mouth, it seemed so clear, this filling up of emptiness, the way people do with heroin, you know, I have to have a sofa. You know, nobody has to have a sofa. it seems so, as you were saying, pathetic and terrifying, actually. like the Philippine woman with her 350 pairs of shoes. I mean, even 10 cars. What does that mean? So I heard what you were saying, and it's something that I've thought about too before. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
May I?
Yes, hello, Krisha.
Hi, everyone. well, tonight I'm with you know, when you are really distracted and it's really difficult to be in the practice, I am in one of those days, but I'm very glad I'm here anyway. So, I think I would really like to thank you, Roshi, for the evolution, sticking with us, not in a clinging way. And thank God you didn't give up. I only met you by 2015. And I think it's really important. You are in Portugal with our Sangha, your way. It's the first teacher I really liked and put me in a Sangha, in a supported way. And I think it's the best thing we can do, taking all this so much challenges about living. It's a great opportunity for us to grow in a whole. We grow ourselves, but in a whole, remembering we are a whole, as todo. And yeah, that is very important and good. And please stay. Keep doing it. We will be here. Why you? I didn't know you when you were beginning. I remember Joa talking about this. I understand it's very frustrating. I really don't know how, why, because sometimes it can be so fashionable and appealing to everyone. Everyone loves to say, comment, whatever, and then nobody goes. Even we have difficulties as a Sangha to meet when Amy is not with us, and in somehow strengthening the Sangha, which is a thing that I personally get frustrated sometimes, but it is what it is. And you also talked about a lot of generosity. And yes, it's I remember, but I think this is the formal stuff about serving. Give yourself, not expecting anything, but just because you really don't want it, you're not in an effort. It's what you want to do. Yeah. It's certainly what I want to do, although it's not easy as a Sangha member. I'm not in your shoes. but I have you. We all have each other, and I'm very glad. And it's great that we are celebrating the 20 years. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, and it's important that we're celebrating the 20 years in the Sangha, because it's, like you say, you know, we are all together and we support each other, and we, that's what's to be celebrated. No. Yeah. Marlene.
This may be a silly question, but because I don't know, I can only imagine what Joa feels in those situations. But Joa, I missed you a lot last summer. And I'm sure some of us too. So you have your own way. I don't know what is the process, but I believe it's not a very easy one. But yes, I thought about you, and I would like you to come.
I miss you too.
Yeah.
It is part of the process, and but it is hard.
I just wanted to say thank you. Yeah, because if you had let Amy in the stay in the way 20 years ago or 18 years ago or whatever, I guess yeah, we wouldn't be here tonight together. That's really precious. And I was thinking about the generosity and Marlene asking, do people sometimes say no when you're given a task? And I don't know if you've ever said no's, but it just reminded me when you asked me to do that first Dharma talk, and I wish I so much hoped I could say no, but I couldn't. Couldn't. It was because yeah, it was so there's something in what in this whole in our practice in this way that is beyond us, unexplainable. And that's why I think we don't say no. You can't. It's too deep and strong and yeah. And it's not about us, as you were saying. So thank you. And it's good to be back.
Thank you. Yeah, is good to be back.
Roshi, you mentioned the cats.
Yeah.
It just I just realized I was looking at my phone. I found the picture of the cat, and I don't know if you can see.
Yeah, great.
And it just occurred to me that these cats basically more or less arrived in our lives when we started the group, and they lived over 17 years, and so they really they really covered now. Unfortunately, the last one died a couple of months ago, but they really covered the whole.
Actually, you had two different cats when we started. They
Yeah,
were like these,
but very quickly these
they
ones
died,
passed away. They
yeah.
died, and so these two, the last one lived 17 years,
Yeah.
and one 16, and the other one 17. So it's really, it covers a lot of the time when we sat here, Passage Courtois.
And the one who died most recently, she sat with us. Really sat with us. I mean, she was there the whole time. Yeah. Yeah, she just used to jump on our back and scratch and start smelling your underarm. Okay.
Well, and the good thing now that the cats are not there, we because of the cats that are not there anymore, we changed the furnitures, and now we have two couches that we can move around to do more space for the meditation. It's easier to move around. So it's
Different circumstances, different people, different, Okay, I think on that note we should end. Thank you, everyone. we do the vows and the